presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. In this episode of this series, we are going to discuss elections in India and Pakistan and compare them with Iran. Stay tuned, please. India is home to over 1,300,000,000 people. President is elected indirectly in India. In other words, people do not participate in the election. The representatives of three legislative houses, namely People's Lower House, Lok Sabha, Upper House, Rajya Sabha, and States House, vote on behalf of their advocates. The result of presidential election will be determined on a special calculation. The vote of each member of the central or state legislature has a separate value. And the candidate who gains the highest votes will take power. According to Article 79 of the Indian Constitution, the parliament consists of the president, the People's House, and Upper House. The president will be elected by parties of partisan coalition via the Electoral College. The president can be elected 2 terms. Each term takes 5 years. Any problem on the presidential election will be heard and resolved through the Supreme Court of India. The president is not the executive official, and this authority is undertaken by the Prime Minister. Although the president is ceremonial in India, he or she enjoys wide legal authorities according to the constitution. He or she is considered as the head of the legislature, executive and judiciary, and also the commander-in-chief of the armed forces in the country. The constitution has made it clear that the president can wield his or her legal authorities indirectly, except very limited issues. However, it is the Prime Minister who uses all the executive authorities of the President through the Ministerial Council. The president in India should be at least 35 years old, but there is no maximum limit for it. According to Article 61 of the Constitution, if he or she does any action contrary to the Constitution, he or she will be dismissed. His dismissal should get the votes of 1/4 of the MPs, who will do it 4 days after the proposal for dismissal. Many regional and neighboring countries enjoy similarities with Iran in terms of ethnicities, religions, and cultures. India, for instance, enjoys different creeds like Islam, Christianity, Hinduism, and Buddhism. Thus, cultural and religious variety is very important in the country. 85% of the population in India is Hindu and 13.5% is Muslim. Yet India has the highest Muslim population after Indonesia and Pakistan. In Iran, too, there are various ethnicities such as Turk, Lor, Kurd, Baluch, Arab, Turkmen, and so on. There are Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, and others, too, who live peacefully with Muslims. Muslims shape over 99% of the population. Muslims consist of Shias and Sunnis who live brotherly with each other. According to the Constitution, every 150,000 people should have a member in the parliament, but the religious minorities enjoy at least one representative in the parliament, although some of them are below 50,000 in the country. Political analyst and university professor Mohammad Reza Marandi says on restrictions and discriminations for some minorities in India, according to the official statistics, 150 million Muslim citizens live in India who constitute 14% of the population. But during elections, the Muslim community has always been concerned over inattention to their demands by parties and candidates. This comes while Muslims build up an important part of large states like Uttar Pradesh. The election system in Pakistan is like India. In other words, it has been highly affected by the patterns of the British colonial rule and occupation. The people in cities choose their representatives in the form of city councils, and the people in villages choose theirs in the form of village councils. These representatives then are authorized to vote for the members of parliament, and in the end, these MPs will choose the president without the people's involvement. This system has changed since 1935 Constitution of India and Pakistan in a way that there are voting circles and a criteria for representatives and election are wealth, properties, and graduation level. Voting specifically belongs to the people whose names are registered in the list of participants in the elections, so no one out of the list is entitled to vote.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tensions are growing between the West and Belarus after Minsk scrambled a fighter jet to divert the flight path of a Lithuania-bound Ryanair passenger plane and forced it to land late last month. Minutes after the landing, Belarusian authorities arrested 26-year-old opposition blogger Roman Protasevich and his fiancée who were on the plane. The move infuriated the European Union and the United States.
And Belarus used its control over its airspace in order to perpetrate a state hijacking. Therefore, the safety and security of flights through Belarus airspace can no longer be trusted.
During a summit in Brussels, EU leaders urged carriers based on the bloc to avoid flying over Belarus. In addition, they have agreed to ban Belarusian airlines from using the bloc's airspace and airports. the 27-nation bloc has slammed more economic sanctions on Belarus. The EU says it has indefinitely frozen a 3 billion euro investment package for the country. Minsk's move has been slammed by some EU leaders as, quote, state piracy.
Essentially, Belarus is very highly aligned to Russia, and that is the choice that they made. Well, this doesn't sit well with U.S. imperialist efforts, who want to see all, essentially all countries in the world allied to them and subservient to them. Now, this is part of a larger U.S. strategy to try to encircle Russia within Europe. As we know that the current Ukrainian crisis is going on right now, where NATO-aligned forces are going to be fighting Russian-aligned and full-on Russian forces probably sometime in mid-June when the permafrost finally melts and it's more advantageous to move large vehicles across Ukraine. Belarus is allied to Russia.
Belarus says it requested the emergency landing due to a suspected bomb threat on the plane. The airliner then left Minsk for its destination in Lithuania shortly after. In a video broadcast by Belarusian state media, Roman Protasevich said he was in good health and cooperating with the country's officials.
Hello, my name is Roman Protasevich. I was detained yesterday at the Minsk National Airport. I'm now in the Minsk Detention Center number 1. I can say that I don't have any health issues, including heart or any other organs disease. Police officers treat me properly and according to the law. Also, I now continue to cooperate with the investigation and give a confession on organizing mass protests in Minsk.
The opposition was quick to reject the statement, arguing that Protasevich was confessing under duress. But Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the West of seeking to provoke unrest in his country. In a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko said the West is trying to, quote, rock the boat to cause a new round of protests against his government. He was referring to the outbreak of protests after the 2020 presidential election when his opponent and Western countries accused his government of voter fraud. President Putin has also warned the West against meddling in Belarus's internal affairs. He also dismissed speculations that Russia participated in diverting the airliner.
This isn't simply someone being targeted by a country for, you know, whatever reason. There is a very clear process here. Person is wanted for a crime, and if they pass through the country, then they are going to be stopped. I mean, this is not even comparable to, say, the Chinese Huawei CFO who was stopped in Canada for a crime that doesn't even exist there.
The recent incident wasn't the first that led to rising tensions between the West and Belarus, which is in a union state with Russia, and will certainly not be the last.
Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. The UN says 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from famine. Yemen has struggled with mass outbreaks of infectious diseases, and poverty has surged to affect as much as 78% of the population since 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional states launched a devastating war on Yemen. The U.S. and several other Western countries have participated in the war by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi coalition. The United Nations says the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from an indirect cause such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. While the results of the US-sponsored Saudi aggression on Yemen speak for themselves, Washington is trying to push a narrative that the Ansarullah movement is mostly to blame for the ongoing problems in Yemen, not Saudi Arabia. after returning from a trip to some Arab states of the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, the U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, accused Ansarullah of refusing a proposed ceasefire. However, the movement has consistently participated in peace talks with the Saudis and allies of former Saudi-backed government. The main reason for the failure of previous peace talks was that the Saudis refused any deal involving power sharing or a fresh election. That's why the Saudi-enforced war on Yemen was aimed at bringing the Saudi-backed former regime to power and crush the popular Ansarullah movement. Despite years of ongoing aggression against Yemenis and spending billions of dollars, Saudi Arabia and its supporter, the U.S., have been unable to defeat the popular Ansarullah movement, and the recent willingness to negotiate a truce proves their weakened position.
The U.S. Narrative should be ignored because it has nothing to do with reality or truth. The people of Yemen continue to suffer because of U.S. actions, because of U.S. sending weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Ansarullah movement has nothing to do with, they're defending the people of Yemen, certainly, but they are not the reason for the war. It is Saudi aggression financed by the United States that is the reason for the war.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen has accused Yemen's Ansarullah movement of not trying to reach an urgently needed ceasefire in the war-torn country. That's why the Biden administration has refused to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen, which is a key Ansarullah condition for a ceasefire. The Saudi-enforced blockade has caused a lack of food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Ansarullah movement, as well as activists and international aid groups, have been calling on Riyadh to separate the blockade from the negotiations and not use the suffering of ordinary Yemenis as a bargaining chip. Moreover, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has tried to show itself as a so-called impartial mediator, trying to resolve the ongoing conflict in Yemen. For instance, in February, the Biden administration announced that the United States was ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen. But Biden said Washington will continue to help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and land. Washington's so-called defensive support for Riyadh includes providing maintenance services to Saudi Arabia's warplanes that are bombing Yemen.
When Joe Biden became president, he made some statements about no longer financing the war in Yemen, no longer supporting it, but he continues to send arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, he calls these defensive, but that's not what they're used for. As long as the profits continue to flow to the United States, the government doesn't care who's dying. The U.S. government doesn't care whose blood is flowing, whose children are suffering and dying, as long as the profits continue to accrue to the United States. So that's what's happening now. Biden can say that he doesn't support the war anymore, but continues to send armaments that are being used in that war. So it's complete hypocrisy, which is typical for the United States. It's an ongoing, unfortunate tradition with the United States, and it's not going to stop under Joe Biden.
Washington previously announced it is halting its support for offensive Saudi-led operations in Yemen, but the U.S. is still helping Saudis in the Yemen war. Furthermore, Washington has refrained from holding Saudi Arabia accountable for the current crisis in Yemen as it has refused to pressure Riyadh into lifting the blockade on Yemen or to end its aggression. And that is a clear sign of the U.S. shielding of Saudi Arabia and Washington's contribution to this war.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, "Taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states." He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass-starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the U.S. blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned, no stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate that conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impact of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
An open letter by dozens of European officials, the purpose to end unwarranted public criticism of inquiries into alleged Israeli war crimes in Palestine. Such is the context of an apparent push by 50 European officials to have the ICC complete its investigation. These officials include former foreign ministers, prime ministers, and senior international officials, including two British Conservative former ministers. Roadblocks were thrown the ICC's way when the inquiry opened. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sanctioned ICC court officials from pursuing the matter, something the new U.S. administration reversed.
Well, Donald Trump's position was highly criticized by various governments and many other people, because it was, you know, just totally out of line. There's no question in my mind that Israel's committed human rights violations, and to exempt Israel from any sort of scrutiny is a travesty of justice.
The ICC has less to worry about, at least for now. The letter reads that the purpose of the court is well established and recognized, that accountability for serious rights violations by all sides through conflict is essential for achieving sustainable and lasting peace. The key question is, Will the ICC's findings be grounds for holding anyone accountable for prosecution if guilty of war crimes and human rights violations?
Israel's afraid that there will be international warrants issued for various Israeli officials who participated in the planning and directing the attack on Gaza. Gaza is the most densely populated place on the planet. And, you know, if you look at the pictures, you know, whole families were targeted and killed. And it's grossly disproportionate in terms of what the Palestinians were doing. And Israel's attack on Palestinians in Jerusalem was the initial cause of that, which is also very troubling.
The former Danish foreign minister and former president of the UN General Assembly have said a rules-based global order is predicated upon the idea that violations of international law must be met with consequences. The United States and, more importantly, Israel in this case, are not members of the ICC, so they do not fall under the ICC's jurisdiction. But the ICC, as an international criminal court, can pursue the rule of law, in this case, violations of human rights in occupied Palestine. The investigation, in many cases, should be an open and shut case, since there are obvious Israeli violations that have taken place over the decades. So many violations that in a recent report, Human Rights Watch called Israel an apartheid regime. This was quite significant since for the first time ever, Human Rights Watch made the informed and evidence-based assessment that the actions of the Israeli regime with regards to its treatment of the Palestinian people has crossed the threshold qualifying it as apartheid.
I certainly concur with Human Rights Watch's assessment. Several Israeli human rights organizations, B'Tselem, have said the same thing. And if you look at the evidence, there is, it's clear that much of the Israeli policy is punitive. In fact, current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is quoted, saying that how he was going to punish the Palestinians and how they would, squeeze them and actually instigate problems for them so they could reach out and attack the Palestinian population.
Israel finds itself in a precarious state. With no functioning system of governance and isolation on the international stage, it is a very fragile entity. To add to Israel's worry, it's been revealed that the leaders of the resistance groups Hamas and Hezbollah met last year to discuss plans for the liberation of Palestine from the Israeli occupation. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza War was also part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during the 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. This only means that the Israeli regime's days of violating the Palestinian rights are numbered. Forced evictions, detainment without charge, freedom of movement, home demolitions, and the killing of Palestinians are illegal actions that happen almost on a daily basis. Plus, the three Gaza wars were proof of Israel's disproportionate killing of Palestinians. The question now remains whether a judicial body can prosecute Israel and its officials into obvious cases of war crimes, regardless of the U.S. obstruction of justice in favor of Israel.
When you have former prime ministers, ministers in governments, and high-ranking officials calling for the International Criminal Court to exercise its rights and to investigate war crimes, this is an opportunity to review Israel's actions and, of course, hold them accountable. And there could be warrants issued by the International Criminal Court.
The EU is Israel's biggest trading partner. Of these high-ranking EU officials who really want justice to prevail, they can economically sanction Israel, as called by the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, if Israel does not cooperate with the investigation. Israel faces ever-growing isolation in the international arena and risks continuing with its violations.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma inni as'aluka bi rahmatika allati wasi'at kulla shay wa bi quwwatika allati qahart biha kulla shay wa khada'a laha kullu shay.
So, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the different manifestations of the Almighty Allah's mercy. Allahumma inni as'aluka birahmatika allati wasi'at kulla shay. O Allah, I ask you by your mercy that envelops everything. We talked about the different parts of the creation, different stages of creation actually, and some of the parts of human body. Now, when we talk about the defensive system of the body, we also have to take some things into consideration. When the omnipotent Allah created the human body, He granted it 5 protective walls against the microbes and the diseases. The skin that we talked about earlier, and it has covered all the body like a fort. After that, under the skin are the ganglion tissues that are cotton-like milky tissues, which sometimes change color. They are under the skin and they are thick in some areas, also thin in others. If something harmful penetrates through the skin, it faces the resistance of these tissues. After that, the mucous membranes, which are membranes surrounding some body organs in order to protect them, and are of the same color as the organs. Some of the organs, like the heart, have 2 membranes, one that surrounds the outer part of the heart and another that is inside the heart. After that, there comes the turn of the stomach acid that eliminates anything harmful which is past other protective walls of the body. And at last, the white globules that are ball-shaped beings in the blood, and they fight the microbes that have entered the blood system, and these globules eradicate them completely. And interestingly, these white balls cooperate with the useful microbes that enter the body. Now, isn't that Almighty Allah's mercy granted to all these guards that protect human beings from diseases and viruses? How extended could Almighty Allah's mercy be? It extends to the inner realm of the human body and also every fragment of his being. Now, let's come out of the human system, human body system, and have a look at the surrounding. For example, the plants. No one knows the exact number of different plants, of how they process the vitamins and the role they play in human life, except Allah, who is the creator of them. Since the plants are also the part of kulla shay, Allahumma inni as'aluka bi rahmatika allati wasi'at kulla shay, to which Almighty Allah's mercy is granted, a brief account of their duty in the life of other creatures might be useful for us. So, oxygen is the vital gas for existence of every living creature. In fact, no human, animal, or even the plant can continue life without it. And the oxygen entering human lungs by breathing is combined with the blood and is distributed throughout the body through blood circulation. Oxygen burns the food in all the cells very slowly, and as a result, it produces natural body heat. By burning the food, a poisonous gas called carbon dioxide is produced, which goes into the lungs with the blood and enters the air when we exhale. all the living things take the oxygen from the atmosphere and send out carbon dioxide.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Oh Allah, bless Muhammad and his progeny. Oh Allah, I beseech you, by your mercy which encompasses everything, and by your power by which you overcome everything, and which submits to it everything, and humble before it is everything. And by your might by which you conquer everything, and by your majesty against which nothing can stand, and by your greatness which prevails over everything, and by your authority which is exercised over everything, and by your own self that shall endure forever after everything has vanished, and by your names which manifest your power over everything, and by your knowledge which pervades everything, and by the light of your face which illuminates everything. O he who is light, O he most holy, O he who is light, O he most holy.
Now, each person usually exhales about 250 grams of pure carbon dioxide out of his lungs during 24 hours. And if we assume the population of humans to be 3 billion, they produce approximately 273,750,000 tons of poisonous dioxide a year. Carbon dioxide, I mean. About the same amount of this gas is produced by the animals too. Now, the question is, where does this constantly produced toxic gas go? If it exists in the air and the amount of oxygen is decreasing, the oxygen-carbon dioxide balance should be changed. Why is it then that all human beings and all animals can actually keep on living? The answer to this question is also provided by the Almighty Allah's mercy. He has created a class of beings whose number is infinite and their breathing is completely against that of other living things. They take the carbon dioxide from the air and give out oxygen instead. So the plants receive carbon from the air and they do this by their leaves, retaining it in their stem and give out oxygen to the air. So a major substance in plants is carbon. And based on the Quranic verses and the statement of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Dua al-Kumail, Allah's mercy has surrounded every leaf and keeps the living world away from total washout. The signs of His mercy are seen in the stem, in the leaf, in the blossoms and flowers of the plant. And those who cannot see are unwise, and those who do not ponder are ignorant. Thank you for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Erromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. The Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
As the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in India, some auto rickshaw drivers have turned their three-wheelers into makeshift ambulances to provide patients with first aid services.
Those are patients.
In New Delhi, the municipal ambulances are often occupied. There are also some very narrow alleys or built-up areas that are inaccessible by regular-sized ambulances. In these cases, our makeshift ambulances came in handy then. We attend to people in need with oxygen cylinders.
Mishra, who started the Rickshaw Ambulance Initiative, says his center attends around 1,200 calls per day. He says rickshaw volunteers transport roughly 150 patients during peak hours. The brave drivers work 12-hour shifts and mainly serve people with mild symptoms. They wear full protective gear, including face shields, while on duty. The three-wheeler ambulances are easily identifiable by the large printed image of the fleet and emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under full control in India. In Russia, drone enthusiasts have gathered in the capital, Moscow, to show off their technological creativity in a racing competition. The participants created their own drones and made changes to the models right on the site where the competition was held to improve their chances to win the contest. The goal was for the participants to complete the track in the shortest possible time. Participants say the interesting thing about the competition is that it's cheaper than other games.
It's a lot of fun. From the outside, it may not be so clear, but when you're inside it, it becomes really fun to talk, race with the competitors, learn from their experience some new technological things. As for the high cost, it is expensive, but when compared with the snowboards and skis, it is really cheaper, but more expensive than knitting.
In 2017, the International Federation of Aeronautics, or FAI, announced drone racing as an official sport. In 2018, Russia's sports ministry included drone racing in all Russian register of sports with a class code F3U following the FAI classification.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Two Russian cosmonauts have conducted spacewalk outside the International Space Station to prepare an old docking module for disposal. The duo spent more than 7 hours outside the ISS to wrap up preparations for the eventual disposal of the Pris docking compartment. According to NASA officials, the Russian cargo freighter will remove the two-decade-old module from the orbiting laboratory later this summer. Both the cargo ship and a press will burn up in the atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The orbiting press will clear the way for the arrival of a new Russian multipurpose laboratory module named Nuka, meaning science in Russian. Nuka is scheduled to launch on July the 15th this year. Wednesday's operation was the sixth spacewalk in 2021 in support of the space station assembly, maintenance, and upgrades.
A rare albino baby elephant that was rescued from poachers in South Africa has found a new home with a welcoming herd. The calf, named Han Yisa, was caught in a snare in the Kruger National Park when she was only 4 months old. She suffered several nasty wounds, including one to her mouth. Han Yisa remained trapped in the snare for 4 days before being rescued and taken to a shelter especially built for elephants northeast of Johannesburg. All the other elephants there are orphans too.
Each female that we had has a baby. So except for them, all of the others are orphaned. And I think that is part of the reason why they accept these orphans, because they know how it feels, you know, and they become actually, you know, the mother figures for them.
The calf has learned to adapt to the new life. She lies under the shadow cast by bigger elephants to protect herself from getting sunburned. The shelter says if the herd grows too big for the area, she and other elephants will be released into the wild. A Brazilian artist has found a way to reuse plastic bags in a very creative way, making something beautiful out of them. Eduardo Sroa turns recycled shreds of plastic into real pieces of artwork. He picks up the material from city streets and rivers. Without using a drop of paint, Sroa recreates paintings by Picasso, Van Gogh, and other famous artists. He says his goal is to draw attention to plastic pollution.
I present this series as a product that does not have paint, except for what has already been processed into plastic by the industry. It does not have glue. It is a box that was built, and inside I press and condense it. I make an accumulated cluster of plastic bags that ends up creating this image that you see.
Sura's exhibition is due to open in Sao Paulo in the coming months. His previous works were also aimed at raising awareness about the environment. He has created several giant installations in public places, mostly along polluted rivers.
Chinese archaeologists have unearthed a rare 3,000-year-old bronze figure from a site they have been excavating for months in Sichuan province. The 1.5-meter figure, deemed one of China's most famous archaeological discoveries. It consists of two parts. The upper part is 55 centimeters high with a zoon, a vessel used in ancient times, on top of the head. The lower part is 60 centimeters in size with kneeling posture. Similar findings in the past were just 20 centimeters in their heights. The bronze figure was discovered under massive ivory objects. So far, over 500 objects, including ivory, bronze, gold, and jade ware, have been found from six sacrificial pits of the Sanjiangdu ruins. A Chinese man becomes the first blind Asian mountaineer to successfully scale the world's tallest peak, the Mount Everest. Zhang Hong completed the 8,849-meter high Himalayan feat with three high-altitude guides. The 46-year-old climber said he spent much of his trek holding onto his guide's arm. The pair said the most tiresome and risky areas were the so-called death zones, ice walls, and ice falls at around 8,000 meters. The Chinese climber recalled humbly embracing being part of Mother Nature after he completed his arduous journey.
No matter if you're disabled or normal, whether you have lost your eyesight or you have no legs or hands, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a strong mind, you can always complete anything that other people think you can't.
Zhang added that this is only the beginning. He said his next milestone is climbing the highest peaks from the world's continents known as the Seven Summits. The Chinese mountaineer lost his eyesight at the age of 21. After his success, he became the third visually impaired person to ever step foot on the Everest peak. A Russian company has developed a fully self-driving car that looks like it was taken right out of a sci-fi movie. Flip is the size of a conventional passenger car and has enough space for six people. Its creator says the advanced vehicle is a taxi of the future. Flip has fulfilled the requirements of international automated driving standards. It's powered by electricity, but it can also use other fuels like gas and hydrogen. The owners of this futuristic vehicle do not have to worry about running out of power. That's because its replaceable batteries can be changed in less than 5 minutes once they are out of electricity. A rare baby giraffe is born in a zoo in western France as conservationists try to increase the population of this endangered species. The cute Rothschild giraffe is the second born in a French zoo this year. Caretakers say the cubs will stay with a facility for 1 year before they would be sent to another site to start their own families. The Rothschild giraffes are critically endangered, and conservationists say that only 1,600 of them exist now. The general giraffe populations in the wild have also decreased by around 30% in the last 3 decades.
For many professional climbers, ascending Mount Everest for even once remains an almost distant dream. However, a Nepali man has achieved that feat not once or twice, but 25 times. Kami Rita Sherpa has arrived back in the capital, Kathmandu, after breaking his own whopping record of 24 ascents to the summit of the world's tallest mountain. The veteran climber hopes that his accomplishment represents a big achievement for his small country. Climbing tall mountains runs in Kami's blood. He belongs to the Sherpa tribe, one of the Tibetan ethnic groups and native to the most mountainous region of Nepal.
IRIB English Radio.